Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, bringing you the Startups Edition for Monday, June 1st, 2026.
Our focus today is the fundamental decoupling of productivity from headcount, as the emergence of agentic workflows shifts the primary bottleneck from labor availability to compute orchestration. We are moving from an era of human-led execution to one defined by autonomous, high-frequency decision loops.
So it is no longer about how many people you hire, but how well you program them.
Something to flag here, the unit economics of scaling are being rewritten by these new autonomous architectures.
We begin by examining the implications of this shift within the new industrial frontier. Four public companies are on track to spend $800 billion on capital expenditures in 2026, which is a somewhat modest way of saying we are currently witnessing the most expensive industrial expansion in human history.
It is a massive shift, Maya. And we are seeing the software is eating the world thesis evolve into a much more capital-intensive reality, where the success of AI-driven industries like robotics and defense depends on transitioning venture-backed companies into more efficient, lower-cost debt and equipment rental models.
It sounds like the lean startup era just hit a brick wall made of copper wiring and concrete.
It's more than just a wall, it's a structural bottleneck. David George has argued that the current AI market is defined by supply constraints in compute, memory, data center capacity, and power, rather than a demand-driven bubble, which essentially acts as a buffer against the kind of classic bubble we've seen in previous tech cycles.
So we aren't in a bubble, we're just stuck in a very expensive traffic jam.
Stepping back, a very long one at that. George notes that the US infrastructure build-out is currently roughly 1 year behind schedule, meaning we won't see large-scale data center capacity available at scale until late 2028 or even early 2029.
So the frontier is currently just a construction site with a massive deficit in permits.
And that's where the finance sector has to step in to bridge the gap. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Mark Rowan described the scale of the shift in capital expenditure for data centers and energy as being every dollar since the invention of fire. This massive demand is forcing a fundamental merger between the finance and technology sectors that simply didn't exist a decade ago.
I assume this means the era of growth at all costs via pure equity is getting a bit crowded.
It's becoming untenable. The modern corporate CFO is now moving toward a three-tiered financing strategy, using banks for short-term liquidity, public markets for plain vanilla needs, and private markets for the complex, non-standardized requirements like these energy and data center projects. We're seeing a move away from pure equity toward parceling risk through credit markets.
So instead of just looking for the next unicorn, investors are looking for the next utility company with a really good algorithm.
That's a sharp way to put it. This is why financial entrepreneurs are becoming as critical as technical ones, as they provide the specialized credit needed to scale physical infrastructure. We're even seeing a parallel in the equity markets, where the concentration risk in U.S. equities, where 10 stocks represent nearly 50% of the S&P 500, is mirroring a structural shift in global fixed income, moving from a landscape dominated by 10 large banks to one controlled by 5 banks and 5 tech giants.
It's getting very small at the top very quickly.
And that concentration is meeting a massive energy hurdle. There is a growing consensus that to prevent local energy costs from skyrocketing, a new operational standard is emerging where data center development must be energy paired, ideally bringing independent power sources like nuclear microreactors directly to the site.
Because apparently, plugging a trillion parameter model into the local municipal grid is a bit of a bad look for the neighbors.
It's a necessity. Mark Andreessen has pointed out that heavy regulation and frameworks like NEPA act as de facto bans on American industrial resurgence, having successfully moved semiconductor manufacturing from California to Taiwan by making domestic production legally unfeasible. Without independent, stable power, the software leadership the U.S. holds in AI won't translate to physical world dominance.
Which brings us to the terrifying reality that while we win at the code, we might lose at the hardware.
That is the critical geopolitical imbalance. The U.S. maintains leadership in AI software, but China's dominance in robotics manufacturing creates a massive security risk regarding physical AI autonomy and surveillance. If you can write the brain but can't build the body, you're vulnerable.
Which is why we're seeing this sudden, frantic pivot back to heavy industry, like this Port Alpha project in the U.S.
Two things stand out. The goal is to use autonomous technologies to expand into high-capacity commercial shipping, everything from bulk carriers to oil tankers, to ensure energy dominance. Dyno Mavrukas has characterized projects like Port Alpha as a generational opportunity to build national infrastructure by focusing on autonomous platforms and vessels.
It's an interesting strategy. Use the tech that's supposed to replace humans to instead rebuild the factories that humans used to run.
It's about creating wartime production capacity during peacetime. As Michael Duffy has emphasized, the defense industrial base cannot exist without a foundational industrial base. The strategy here is to decouple manufacturing scale from government procurement. You need the commercial maritime market to be viable so that the capacity exists when the defense sector needs it. We're seeing the integration of autonomous technology as the primary driver for both modernizing naval operations and scaling large-scale manufacturing processes.
It's a massive, expensive, and highly regulated gamble on being able to actually build things again.
It's a gamble on whether we can master the physical layer. If we can't, the innovator's dilemma in AI will manifest as a cost-driven shift toward secondary models, where Chinese LLMs operating at just 10% of the cost of US frontier models could capture massive market share, even with a 6-month capability lag. The goal is to use deep infrastructure ownership to drive margins, much like how Jeeves expanded gross margins from 4% to over 80% by capturing the value previously paid to partners.
The winners won't just be the ones with the best models, but the ones who actually own the power plant and the shipyard.
There's a signal here. The winners will be the ones who can bridge the gap between the digital intelligence and the physical energy required to run it.
Infrastructure investors need to start looking at nuclear microreactors and autonomous maritime logistics as much as they look at GPU clusters.
Watch for the first major US-based data center that successfully goes off-grid with its own dedicated nuclear capacity. That will be the signal that the energy pairing standard has officially moved from theory to implementation.
But if we can solve the power problem, the next big bottleneck might be how much we can actually delegate to these machines when they start handling their own complex workflows. Less than 0.5%. That is the current share of the software market represented by token-based pricing models. We are told we are entering the age of the autonomous agent, yet 65 to 75% of software spend is still locked in traditional seat-based contracts.
Sounds like a massive gap, but the SaaSpocalypse narrative is empirically unsupported by actual business spend data the A16Z show. The real shift isn't happening in how companies pay, but in what the software actually does, moving from systems of record that just store data to systems of action that can execute multi-step business processes.
We're moving from a digital filing cabinet to a digital employee that can actually send emails and browse the web.
Founders are arguing that the true value of enterprise AI lies in resolving coordination problems, rather than just automating isolated tasks the A16Z show. Think of it as an orchestration layer that can jump between your CRM, your ERP, and even your phone calls to manage a workflow. On the A16Z show, it was noted that the competitive advantage is shifting from model capability to developer experience and automated routing, much like how Cursor is competing with GitHub Copilot by managing model selection for the user.
That sounds great for efficiency, but for a startup, orchestration sounds like a lot of expensive, uncoordinated chaos. How do you actually build this without just burning through a seed round on API calls?
It's a massive engineering hurdle, but there's a way to seed it. The cold start problem in enterprise AI can be solved by using forward-deployed engineers to manually capture tribal knowledge and interview operators, which effectively creates a state graph that allows subsequent agent deployments to scale via flywheel effect the A16Z show. As these agents perform work, they create a cleaner, more enriched business context, which then enables even more complex automation.
So the agent is essentially cleaning its own workspace as it goes.
It's a telling detail. Pablo Palafox argues that executing tasks via agents serves as a latent data cleaning mechanism, where the agent's diligence in recording information progressively scrubs dirty legacy systems through high-dimensional semantic updates. It's turning invisible, messy back-end work like data entry or manual logistics coordination into something observable and shareable across the company.
I can see the appeal for a logistics startup, but I'm looking at the unit economics and seeing a nightmare. If I'm running an autonomous system, my costs are no longer a predictable monthly subscription. They are tied to how much the agent thinks.
That is the primary risk. The true ROI of agents remains incalculably volatile in the short term because the cost of running them is highly variable. You have to monitor token consumption to see if the agent is actually cheaper than a human pioneers of AI. However, when it works, the leverage is staggering. Dilip Thajman has pointed to a future of programmable money where agents handle specialized tasks, like GL coding agents achieving 99% accuracy in mapping transactions to ERP systems. We're already seeing advanced fintech scaling achieve a margin expansion paradox, where companies are growing revenue tenfold while actually decreasing headcount through AI-driven, underwriting the A16Z show.
A four-person team managing $3 billion in payment volume. That is a terrifyingly efficient way to scale, provided the probabilistic nature of the AI doesn't decide to hallucinate a few zeros into the ledger.
That's why the industry is moving toward a hybrid intelligence model. You can't just rely on the probabilistic nature of LLMs. You have to layer in deterministic business logic and a shared context layer to coordinate multiple agents, like managing competing bids for a single freight load.
It sounds like a massive structural misalignment, though. If the frontier model providers like OpenAI or Anthropic are running on 80% token-based revenue models, they have no incentive to build the very auto-routing features that would lower your costs and make these agents more efficient the A16Z show.
You've hit on the central tension. The long-term profitability of the whole ecosystem depends on a market structure where the value of companies built on top of tokens, the ones actually solving the coordination problems, exceeds the value of the underlying AI platforms themselves.
Investors need to stop looking at model benchmarks and start looking at how much invisible work a startup can actually make visible.
Keep a close eye on the emergence of answer engine optimization. It's a new high-growth software category that the big model companies can't effectively serve because they lack the neutral cross-model oversight required to track performance across the whole ecosystem.
But if the software is handling the workflow, what's left for the humans to do?
The argument is that the strategic reallocation of human cognitive energy will shift from operational problem-solving to social capital cultivation.
We're essentially outsourcing the boring stuff so we can focus on being more intensely human.
Or just so we can focus on the next layer of complexity.
Software founders should prioritize building the orchestration layer rather than just another model wrapper. Watch for the first major spike in token-related operational volatility, because that will be the moment the predictable SaaS era truly breaks.
But as the machines take over the logistics, the real question becomes how the founders themselves manage the psychological toll of this new reality.
I spent most of last night staring at a spreadsheet of our burn rate, and I think I've officially entered the stage of founder burnout where every Slack notification feels like a personal attack, a looming bankruptcy, or a direct summons from a Victorian ghost.
That's a heavy triad, Maya, but it sounds like you're describing the universe of entropy that Sami Inkainen, CEO of Virta Health, talks about. That feeling that without a rigid structural architecture, the sheer randomness of running a large-scale company will eventually consume your entire identity.
We can trace that further. I feel like if I don't build a moat around my sanity, I'm just going to evaporate into a cloud of unreplied emails.
Well, the moat usually starts with how you manage your internal cognitive load. A lot of founders think productivity is about the volume of tasks completed, but Inkainen argues that true executive productivity is actually defined by the quality of your decision-making. If you're stuck in a loop of false productivity, clearing trivial tickets just to feel useful, you aren't actually mitigating risk. You're just generating a high-velocity illusion of utility.
So instead of a to-do list, I should be building a fortress of focus.
More like a weekly architecture. Inkainen uses a highly structured system. Group meetings on Mondays, one-on-ones on Tuesdays, and dedicated no-meeting deep work Wednesdays to protect his cognitive energy from context switching. He even uses a 5-minute Sunday planning routine to prevent the chaos of a 1,000-person company from overriding his strategic objectives. It's about using structure to create the space for structured spontaneity.
That sounds great for someone who already has their life together, but what about the mental noise? The constant monkey mind that keeps you up at 3:00 a.m. wondering if your Series B is doomed.
That's where the physiological side comes in. On FOMO Sapiens, Patrick J. Maginis and Laura L. Rubin discussed how you can use journaling as a literal workshop for anxiety. The goal isn't just to vent, but to move from a monkey mind state, where you're just reacting to every impulse, to a monk mind state of focused presence.
I've tried journaling. It usually ends with me writing I am tired 40 times in a row.
You might be doing it too digitally. Rubin points out that the neurological benefits are significantly amplified when you use pen and paper. The physical movement of your hand across the page creates specific synaptic connections that digital typing just can't replicate. It actually triggers a physiological serotonin bath and lowers cortisol, because your brain struggles to distinguish between a vivid, written visualization and a real experience.
If I write down that I've successfully closed the round, my brain thinks it's actually happened. That sounds like a bit of a cheat code.
It's less of a cheat and more of a way to differentiate between actual truths and catastrophizing fantasies. Writing it down forces you to move from a catastrophic, future-focused narrative to a concrete analysis of which fears are likely and which are just fiction. If you're struggling with the blank page, Rubin suggests the 4-4-4 microdosing method. Journal for 4 minutes, 4 days a week for 4 weeks. It lowers the barrier to entry and uses those small, achievable wins to secure dopamine hits.
I can probably manage 4 minutes. I can also manage 5 minutes of writing down every sound and smell in the room if I'm starting to spiral.
That's actually a recognized grounding exercise for burnout. But you also have to manage your identity footprint. On the Tim Ferriss Show, it was noted that what we often call parental rage or founder burnout is often just a symptom of identity loss. If your only identity is CEO of a struggling startup, then every setback is an existential crisis. Inkainen suggests cultivating multiple identities, being an athlete, a parent, or part of a peer group, so that when the professional identity faces a crisis, the entire system doesn't collapse.
It's basically diversifying your psychological portfolio.
The pattern is clear. Even your morning routine can be a defensive tool. Inkainen uses a boot-up sequence of physical shocks, like cold lake immersion, to bypass morning rumination. He uses low-stakes altruism, like making coffee for his wife, to establish a functional mindset before any cognitive work begins. It's about using physical movement and service to bypass the need for raw willpower.
It's a lot of heavy lifting for a Monday morning.
It's the price of high-performance consistency. You have to build the architecture before the entropy arrives.
Founders need to start treating their cognitive architecture with the same rigor they apply to their cap tables.
Watch for the AI vampire effect in your engineering teams, where extreme efficiency gains lead to even higher labor intensity and sleep deprivation rather than actual downtime.
That's a grim way to scale. But let's pivot to something slightly more optimistic. How do you actually know if the product you're building is something people will actually pay for? I don't know, Alex. This whole playbook for product market fit feels like a collection of expensive excuses for why a startup isn't actually growing. We're not failing, we're intentionally controlling the blast radius. It sounds like a founder trying to explain why their house is on fire.
It's not about the fire, Maya, it's about the architecture of the burn. If you look at how Superhuman approached it, they didn't just wait for users to stumble in. They used a high-touch manual onboarding process to ensure the early cohort became brand advocates. They weren't chasing mass adoption, they were engineering scarcity.
Right, because nothing says scalable tech company like personally handholding 5 people a week through an email interface. It's like trying to build a global airline by personally driving every passenger to the terminal in your own sedan.
But that precision allows you to optimize the core before you expand. On the A16Z show, Rahul Vora noted that Superhuman actually increased their very disappointed user metric from 22% to 32% simply by narrowing their market segmentation, specifically by excluding personas like engineers and sales teams who had different needs. They realized that achieving product market fit is often more about which customers you exclude than which features you build.
So the strategy is just being picky. Just tell people you don't like them and call it strategic segmentation.
It's about protecting the product from becoming a muddy mess. If you try to serve everyone, you end up with a feature set that satisfies no one. Even the pricing reflects this. Instead of a traditional freemium model, which can often just be a way to subsidize marketing costs without driving real growth, they used a premium $30 a month model. They leveraged the psychological identity of high-stakes professionals, the idea that a higher price point actually signals premium value to a CEO or a VC.
I guess it works if you're targeting the aspirational crowd. If you see a billionaire using a specific brand of artisanal salt, you suddenly feel like you need that salt to be taken seriously at dinner parties.
The A16Z show argued that high-end product virality can be engineered without traditional loops by targeting the highest expectation customer. When those influential individuals adopt a tool, it creates an aspirational effect for everyone else. You don't need a refer-a-friend button if the person everyone wants to emulate is already using the product.
But there's a limit to how much you can gatekeep. Eventually, you have to let the masses in.
And that's the cycle. You expand, the very disappointed metric inevitably drops as you hit harder-to-serve markets, and then you have to go back to the lab to optimize again. You focus your improvements on the somewhat disappointed users, the ones who already get the core benefit, rather than trying to convert people who are completely indifferent.
Founders need to start treating their reject pile as a core product feature.
Keep an eye on the churn rate of the premium tier. If the high-end users start fleeing to cheaper multiplayer tools, the prestige model collapses.
But how do you grow that much without the whole thing turning into a corporate bureaucracy? Every founder starts with a mission, but eventually they hit a crossroads between scaling the vision or scaling the exit. Today we're looking at the mechanics of scaling without losing your soul. Alex, if you're betting on a startup, are you looking for the visionaries or the architects of the exit?
I'm looking for the person who understands that success itself is actually a destructive force. On Masters of Scale, it's argued that high-performing companies become golden geese, where the accumulated trust of the brand becomes a prime target for surgical deboning by extractive management.
Surgical deboning. That sounds less like a business strategy and more like a horror movie set in a butcher shop.
It's a bit more clinical, but the result is the same. The mechanism is a shift from a trustee model, where you protect the entity, to an agency model focused on extraction primacy. This isn't just about legal fraud, it's about structural extraction, where profit is generated by harvesting value rather than creating it.
You're saying the more successful you get, the more likely someone is to come in and strip the meat off the bone.
Worth noting that stripping often starts with the capital structure. FOMO Sapiens with Patrick J. McGinnis noted that corporate corruption is often a byproduct of cheap money cycles. When venture debt and abundant capital are available, leaders often abandon operational rigor to chase simple arbitrage, like aggressively inflating your LTV through unsustainable ad spend. You can actually see this manifest physically in the product. Look at how private equity takeovers of companies like Panera Bread can degrade core quality because the drive for growth at all costs incentivizes cost-cutting that breaks the original brand promise.
Wait, so you're telling me that a bad term sheet can literally make my sourdough taste worse?
It's a direct causal chain. Aggressive debt requirements lead to margin pressure, which leads to ingredient substitution, which leads to brand erosion. To survive, you need to integrate magic, the vision, with logic, the systems. It's about being data-informed rather than purely data-driven to preserve that entrepreneurial spark.
But how do you actually scale the magic without just hiring 1,000 people and losing the plot?
You use hyperscalable communication anchors. The Tim Ferriss Show highlighted how leaders like Inkainen maintain connection with thousands of employees not by increasing headcount, but through high-leverage, repeatable systems like a weekly single-topic CEO letter. It keeps the logic of the operation tethered to the magic of the mission.
It sounds like you're describing a very disciplined form of cult leadership.
Or a very disciplined form of stewardship. The goal is to view yourself as a temporary guardian of the brand's DNA. It's even possible to build structures that resist these pressures entirely. Masters of scale pointed out that foundation-owned models like Novo Nordisk can actually outperform traditional for-profits in long-term survival because they aren't structurally incentivized to strip the assets.
Investors in the next seed round should prioritize founders who treat brand trust as a quantifiable asset with locks on the doors rather than a cheap resource to be liquidated. Keep an eye on whether the next wave of AI unicorns stays focused on product utility or if they start pivoting toward aggressive, extractive monetization of user data. As we wrap up this edition, the thread running through everything we've discussed today is the massive pivot from managing human labor to managing computational throughput. We are moving away from the era of scaling via headcount and entering an era where growth is constrained not by talent acquisition, but by the physical availability of power and the efficiency of your token orchestration.
The data tells a story for the startup founder or the VP of engineering. The single most critical shift is that your primary operational bottleneck has moved from the recruitment pipeline to the energy and infrastructure pipeline. You can no longer assume that if you write superior code, you can scale infinitely. Your unit economics are now tethered to the volatility of compute availability and the cost of the electricity required to run it. The decision makers who win this decade won't just be the best architects of intelligence. They will be the ones who successfully navigate the convergence of software, localized power, and hardware logistics. If you aren't thinking about your compute revenue ratio as intensely as your customer acquisition cost, you're building on a foundation of sand.
It's a high-stakes game of balancing rapid agentic automation with the preservation of your company's core value. As we see the shift from seat-based software toward much more volatile usage-based consumption, the margin for error in your pricing model is shrinking.
So here's the picture to see if this thesis holds. Keep a very close eye on the quarterly CapEx reports coming out of the major hyperscalers later this year. Specifically, watch for any significant divergence between their software-level advancements and their actual physical site deployment timelines. If we see a widening gap between algorithmic capability and data center readiness, it will confirm that the bottleneck has officially moved from the digital to the physical realm.
Thanks for joining us this Monday. We'll see you next week.